Welcome to our Local Voices special presentation called A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. A Glance Back is brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and local historian. Local Voices, A Glance Back, a two-hour program, airs every Monday and Friday starting at noon and then again at 4 p.m. The show focuses on the music, radio features, and history of World War II and beyond as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
Whisper soft and low, just once for me to hear the words, I love you, dear. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. Cheerio, here I go on my way. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. With a cheer, not a tear, make it gay. Give me a smile I can keep all the while in my heart while I'm away. Till we meet once again, you and I, wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. I can keep all the while in my heart while I'm away. Till we meet once again, you and I, wish me luck as you wave me.
Taking a glance back at history with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
My brother Bill is in the army now. We heard from him today. His waistline's getting back to normal now. Here's what he had to say.
Mar, I miss your apple pie. Oh, Mama, I miss yours too. Now, Mama, they're treating me all right. But they can't cook just like you. Nobody's spoiling me like you used to do. They won't let me stay in bed until noon. At 5:45, they play me a tune. Oh, Mom, I miss your apple pie. And by the way, I miss you.
I did have grown so lonely. I've lost my one and only. My pride has been humbled.
How you feel,
sir? But I'm for you, bought and sold. I was a mere sensation. My heart was caught with no foundation. Although we have tumbled, but I'm for you, body and soul. But life before me, the future stole me. Winter, that's gray and old. Unless it's magic, the end will be tragic and echo the tale that's been told so often. My life relies upon you. What is the good? Am I without you? My castle has crumbled, but I'm for you, fighting soon.
Listening to Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP. Now, our local historian Jim Steele will take us back to the age of World War II.
This is KPIP Radio 94.7 FM. And today we again welcome you to Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Jim Steele reporting under the sponsorship of the Boone's Lick Historical Society. Well, as you may recall, during the last 3 weeks, we've done a series which examines how Howard County's transportation evolved over the years. from riverboats to stagecoaches to trains, and eventually to highways. Today we continue with an additional look at how trains impacted life in Fayette and Howard County. Now, in those years gone by, newspapers, such as the Democrat Leader and Fayette Advertiser, were tied closely to rail operations. Sometimes letters and articles complained of poor service and or what some readers or the editor may have seen as excessive charges. However, on a happier note, frequent newspaper ads touted special rates to connect the Katy and Katy trains going to St. Louis, Oklahoma, Texas, and elsewhere. Depots, as we've noted earlier, were more than just a place where the train stopped. Even the design of the depot and the equipment represented facets of a unique cultural phenomenon. Everything from the brakeman's lantern to the building's structure was calculated to make travel as far as possible safe and as comfortable as possible. Now, the wooden structure in Fayette that many today still remember, located at the site of the present Dollar General store, was considered state-of-the-art following its completion in 1898, this after fire had destroyed the old station the previous year. The new building was described as follows in the March 31, 1898 issue of the Democrat Leader. It said, "The new MKT Depot has been completed and is now occupied by the road's most obliging agents. The structure is of modern design and is finished up to a queen's taste." That's what it said. "The waiting rooms and the ladies on the north and the gentlemen's on the south are very conveniently arranged and well furnished, contributing to the comforts and pleasures of the traveling public. The office is nicely furnished with the most modern appliances, making the duties of its occupants a pleasure and not a task, as is in many places. The building is also provided with commodious freight and express rooms apart from each other, quite an improvement over the old building. The platform," it goes on to say, "is much improved upon being made larger in every way." Well, it was the wish of everybody in town that the depot be put on the opposite side of the track from where it is now. We can thank the road for giving us such a nice, attractive, and commodious building. Again, that description of the new depot from the Democrat Leader in 1898. Incidentally, other station stops on the Katy were located along what was known as the Moberly Branch Line in Howard County in those years. These included Franklin, New Franklin, Estill, Talbot, Burton, and Higbee, then on to Moberly and Hannibal. Returning briefly to the Katy's initial 1873 push into central Missouri, it was noted that ultimately the MKT trackage running north-south through Howard County and beyond did not pan out financially. Later, it became, in essence, a secondary line. The section from Moberly to Hannibal was sold to the Wabash Railroad in 1944. Passenger traffic through Fayette on the Moberly Branch, say in 1923, had consisted of two daily trains each way. However, by early 1927, this had declined to one passenger train daily and a mixed local. That meant freight and passenger. By the fall of 1927, a gas-electric motor car had been placed into service, and initially it did well. However, within 2 years, it was discontinued, making the mixed local the only scheduled train remaining on the Moberly Branch. Now, once paved highways had reached Fayette starting in the mid-1920s, demand for regular passenger accommodations rapidly dwindled. This, along with the Great Depression and the loss of mail contracts, eventually caused a decline in what evolved into mixed freight passenger service on the line, with only one train a day each way. Occasionally, folks simply were allowed to ride in the caboose. Virtually all passenger service in Howard County had ended by around 1959. Passengers were permitted to ride in the caboose on mixed freight trains until 1964. Well, by the 1960s, the rails from Franklin to Moberly were in awful condition, and it was only an occasional freight that would slowly and very slowly traverse the route perhaps once or twice a week, mostly serving two grain elevators, Midwest Cordage, that was Mexican Twine Company, and bulk fuel for two fuel companies, also Walnut Logs and occasionally newsprint for the Fayette papers. A flood in 1969 had washed out part of the Fayette to Moberly section, which effectively caused that section to be abandoned. Some occasional freight service continued between Franklin and Fayette until the mid-1970s. The Katy filed an abandonment application to discontinue the Moberly branch line entirely, and this was approved in 1975. Sporadic service between Franklin and Fayette continued until until around 1978. By late that year, the remaining trackage of the Moberly branch had been sold and removed for use by a scrap metal contractor. The Fayette station was closed around 1969, which meant that the few remaining customers dealt with the Katy's Franklin office by telephone. The building at Fayette continued to be used for newsprint and lumber storage, but ultimately was razed in 1979, in spite of the efforts of some local fans and rail fans to preserve it. And now we continue our look back at Howard County transportation as we switch gears and start to tell you how highways and the newfangled automobiles impacted this area. Cars, trucks, and the coming of improved roads impacted residents here much as they did for those living elsewhere in the United States. Travelers no longer were confined to the whims and vagaries of train schedules. The first paved highway to reach Fayette was Missouri Highway 5, which linked the city with U.S. 40 at New Franklin. Following completion of the Missouri River Bridge at Boonville in 1924, motorists easily could reach that city and then continue to points west day or night without having to consider the availability of ferry service on the Missouri River. Indeed, by the mid-20s and beyond, it was possible for folks living in central Missouri to, as they put it, motor easily within daylight hours to St. Louis or Kansas City, journeys which would have been fraught with considerable difficulties and adventure only a few years earlier. Now, judging from highway maps, which may be assessed on the Missouri Department of Transportation website, it appears that Highway 5 from New Franklin northward reached Fayette by sometime in the mid-1920s. Apparently, it was hard serviced in increments from New Franklin northward, with the remaining parts of the roadway probably graveled or oiled. Now, the MoDOT map, dated January 1, 1930, shows the highway completely paved from New Franklin to Fayette and then, quote, an improved surface from Fayette to Glasgow. Several letters and news articles tell of less than ideal motoring conditions, especially from Fayette to Glasgow. Over time, all-weather roads came into existence within our county, in addition to Highways 5 and 40. Portions of what had been the old Fayette to Roachport Road evolved into Missouri Highway 240 that formerly had been a part of Highway 3. Insofar as it can be determined from the maps, it was hard-surfaced by the mid-1930s and thus provided quicker access to eastbound Highway 40 and on to Columbia. Starting from the mid-teens and beyond, automobiles had evolved from a toy of the rich to a practical means of transportation for ordinary citizens, mainly due to the low cost, versatility, and toughness of the Ford Model T. Other makes followed suit, and by the 1920s, those cars were giving Ford a run for its money, particularly Chevrolet. During the first 10 or 12 years of the 20th century, the pages of the Fayette Advertiser and Fayette Democrat Leader include relatively few references to automobiles. However, their presence becomes increasingly noted in news accounts from roughly the World War I period onward. Filling stations also began to spring up, with several located on the Fayette Town Square and elsewhere. Other stations came into being in Glasgow, Armstrong, New Franklin, and so forth. In Fayette, a standard station was erected at West Davis and Church around 1925, and in doing so, it negotiated with the Congregation of St. Mary's Episcopal Church to move that historic sanctuary just a few feet down the street on West Davis, where it remains today. The station continues in existence today as the popular home oil station selling Sinclair products. And as cars became more commonplace, the Fayette City Council found itself pressured to pave major streets within the city beyond simply the town square. Howard Countyans also, and other Missouri residents, lobbied the legislature in Jefferson City for better roads. In 1917, the Missouri legislature passed what was known as the Hawes Law, H-A-W-S, so the state could receive federal funds. The legislation also created a state road fund and a four-member state highway board. In 1920, a $60 million bond issue was passed to, as it said, to get Missouri out of the mud. 32 years later, the state highway department took over responsibility for almost 12,000 miles of county highways, bringing 95% of all Missourians within 2 miles of a hard surface road. In 1956, Missouri became the first state of the nation to take bids and begin construction on the interstate highway system. Locally, a direct result of this action came to Howard County in October 1960, when the first section of Interstate 70 to open in central Missouri begins to carry traffic from just east of Columbia to west of Boonville via the new Missouri River Bridge at Roachport, thus avoiding the bottleneck in Boonville. Generally, U.S. 40 and Interstate 70 through Missouri are one and the same, however, the old Highway 40 routing from Midway through Howard County to Boonville via the old 1924 bridge was retained. For local residents, it meant having to deal with much less traffic and making the trip to Columbia. Highways in Howard County have, for the most part, continued on their original alignments because of the perceived greater needs in other parts of the state. Generally, improvements have been restricted to resurfacing in addition to widening small bridge replacements, shoulder safety additions, better markings, and so forth. Notable exceptions have been the new Missouri River bridges at Boonville in 1995 and Glasgow in 2009, and replacement of the Highway 240 twin bridges just south of Fayette that took place around 2010. In addition, Highway 5 in Howard County saw two significant upgrades. Originally, the alignment in Fayette came in from the south, as it does today, then made a sharp right turn on Morrison Street and proceeded to the town square, and then turned left on Church Street while linking with Highway 240 at the Hotel Howard, now the Exchange Bank. It then continued north past the college campus and thence to Glasgow. Around 1950, Highway 5 in Fayette was, as they said, cut through on the west side of the city, proceeding past what is now Fayette High School and eventually emerging with Highway 240 at the triangle just north of the city park, thus avoiding traversing city streets. Just over a half century later, another major 5-240 improvement came following the flood of 1994. A vastly improved roadway starting from Highway 5 intersection, the other side of the triangle, was completed in 2001. With smooth pavement and wide shoulders, motorists could now make the trip from Fayette to Glasgow quicker and safer, an improvement which also included an entirely new section of the highway, eventually connecting with Highway 87. With this development, those traveling to Glasgow could use the, quote, new road to enter Glasgow's front street from the point near where the highway connects with the Missouri River Bridge. Or they could divert from the main highway on the old alignment, now identified as Business 240, and enter the city via the back way, so to speak, past Glasgow High School and then down the hill to Front Street. As the years passed, lesser highways in Howard County were hard surfaced as well, including Missouri's Highway 124, Highway 3, and 87. This in addition to all the lettered roadways. Another significant improvement came in the mid-1990s when the county adopted a unified numbering system for all county-maintained gravel roads. This was a major development which permitted better response times for law enforcement, ambulances, firefighters, and other responders. Those upgrades were enhanced by the adoption of the 911 emergency response system with operators based around the clock in the Keller Building. And beginning in the early 1970s, the county had transitioned from ambulance service provided by local funeral homes to a full-time, professionally staffed, county-owned service funded by the county taxpayers. And we'll tell you more about how other forms of transportation impacted this area in next week's broadcast of KPIP's Local Voices. A Glance Back, I'm Jim Steele reporting for the Boone's Dick Historical Society.
That was our Glance Back in Time with Jim Steele, president of the Boone's Dick Historical Society. This series with Jim Steele will continue every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. during Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
Oh,
This is 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Rachel Steele. On Tuesday, October the 12th, 1937, FDR gave his 10th of 30 radio addresses that would come to be known as Fireside Chats. During these radio chats, the president would inform the American people, build public support for his administration's efforts during the Great Depression, World War II, and the enactment of New Deal policies. Here is Franklin Delano Roosevelt's 9th fireside chat from Tuesday, October the 12th, 1937, entitled On New Legislation to be Recommended to Congress.
Friends, this afternoon I have issued a proclamation calling a special session of the Congress to convene on Monday, November 15th, 1937. I do this in order to give to the Congress an opportunity to consider important legislation before the regular session in January, and to enable the Congress to avoid a lengthy session next year, extending through the summer. I know that many enemies of democracy will say that it is bad for business, bad for the tranquility of the country to have a special session, even one beginning only 6 weeks before the regular session. But I have never had sympathy with the point of view that a session of the Congress is an unfortunate intrusion of what they call politics into our national affairs. Those who do not like democracy want to keep legislators at home. But the Congress is an essential instrument of democratic government, and democratic government can never be considered an intruder into the affairs of a democratic nation. I shall ask this special session to consider immediately certain important legislation which on my recent trip through the nation convinces me the American people immediately need. This does not mean that other legislation, to which I am not referring tonight, is not an important part of our national well-being. But other legislation can be more readily discussed at the regular session. Anyone charged with proposing or judging national policies should have first-hand knowledge of the nation as a whole. That is why, again this year, I have taken trips to all parts of the country. Last spring, I visited the Southwest. This summer, I made several trips in the East. Now, I am just back from a trip all the way across the continent. And later this autumn, I hope to pay my annual visit to the Southeast. For a president especially, it is a duty to think in national terms. He must think not only of this year, but of future years when someone else will be president. He must look beyond the average of the prosperity and well-being of the country, because averages easily cover up danger spots of poverty and instability. He must not let the country be deceived by a merely temporary prosperity, which depends on wasteful exploitation of resources which cannot last. He must think not only of keeping us out of war today, but also of keeping us out of war in generations to come. The kind of prosperity we want is the sound and permanent kind, which is not built up temporarily at the expense of any section or group, and the kind of peace we want is the sound and permanent kind, which is built on the cooperative search for peace by all the nations which want peace. The other day, I was asked to state my outstanding impression gained on this recent trip to the Pacific Coast and back. And I said that it seemed to me to be the general understanding on the part of the average citizen, understanding of the broad objectives and policies which I have just outlined. 5 years of fierce discussion and debate, 5 years of information through the radio and the moving picture have taken the whole nation to school in the nation's business. Even those who have most attacked our objectives have, by their very criticism, encouraged the mass of our citizens to think about and understand the issues involved, and understanding to approve. Out of that process, we have learned to think as a nation. And out of that process, we have learned to feel ourselves a nation. As never before in our history, each section of America says to every other section, "Thy people shall be my people." For most of the country, this has been a good year, better in dollars and cents than for many years, and far better in the soundness of its prosperity. Everywhere I went, I found particular optimism about the good effect on business which is expected from the steady spending by farmers of the largest farm income in many years. But we have not yet done all that must be done to make this prosperity stable. The people of the United States were checked in their efforts to prevent future piling up of huge agricultural surpluses and the tumbling prices which inevitably follow them. They were checked in their efforts to secure reasonable minimum wages and maximum hours and the end of child labor. And because they were checked, many groups in many parts of the country still have less purchasing power and a lower standard of living than the nation as a whole can permanently allow. Americans realize these facts. That is why they ask government not to stop governing, simply because prosperity has come back a long way. They do not look on government as an interloper in their affairs. On the contrary, they regard it as the most effective form of organized self-help. Sometimes I get bored sitting in Washington hearing certain people talk and talk about all that government ought not to do. People who got all they wanted from government back in the days when the financial institutions and the railroads were being bailed out in 1933, bailed out by the government. It is refreshing to go out through the country and feel the common wisdom that the time to repair the roof is when the sun is shining. They want the financial budget balanced, these American people. But they want the human budget balanced as well. They want to set up a national economy which balances itself with as little government subsidy as possible. For they realize that persistent subsidies ultimately bankrupt their government. They are less concerned that every detail be immediately right than they are that the direction be right. They know that just so long as we are traveling on the right road, it does not make much difference if occasionally we hit a thank you, Mom. The overwhelming majority of our citizens who live by agriculture are thinking clearly how they want government to help them in connection with the production of crops. They want government help in two ways. First, in the control of surpluses, and second, in the proper use of land. The other day, a reporter told me that he had never been able to understand why the government seeks to curtail crop production and at the same time to open up new irrigated areas. He was confusing two totally separate objectives. Crop surplus control relates to the total amount of any major crop grown in the whole nation on all cultivated land, good land or poor land, controlled by the cooperation of the crop growers themselves and with the help of the government. Land use, however, is a policy of providing each farmer with the best quality and type of land that we have or can make available for his part in that total production. Adding good new land for diversified crops is offset by abandoning poor land now uneconomically farmed. The total amount of production largely determines the price of the crop, and therefore the difference between comfort and misery for the farmer. Let me give you an example. If we Americans were foolish enough to run every shoe factory 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we would soon have more shoes than the nation could possibly buy. A surplus of shoes, so great that it would have to be destroyed or given away or sold at prices far below the cost of production. That simple illustration, that simple law of supply and demand, equally affects the price of all of our major crops. You and I have heard big manufacturers talk about control of production by the farmer as an indefensible economy of scarcity, as they call it. And yet these same manufacturers never hesitate to shut down their own huge plants, throw men out of work, and cut down the purchasing power of the whole community whenever they think that they must adjust their production to an oversupply of the goods that they make. When it is their baby who has the measles, they call it not an economy of scarcity, but sound business judgment. Of course, speaking seriously, what you and I want is such governmental rules of the game that labor and agriculture and industry will all produce a balanced abundance without waste. So we intend this winter to find a way to prevent 4.5 cent cotton and 9 cent corn and 30 cent wheat with all the disaster those prices mean for all of us, to prevent those prices from ever coming back again. To do that, the farmers themselves want to cooperate, to build an all-weather farm program, so that in the long run, prices will be more stable. They believe this can be done, and the national budget kept out of the red. And when we have found that way to protect the farmers' prices from the effects of alternating crop surpluses and crop scarcities, we shall also have found the way to protect the nation's food supply from the effects of the same fluctuation. We ought always to have enough food at prices within the reach of the consuming public. For the consumers in the cities of America, we must find a way to help the farmers to store up in years of plenty enough to avoid hardship in the years of scarcity. Our land use policy is a different thing. I have just visited much of the work that the national government is doing to stop soil erosion, to save our forests, to prevent floods, to produce electric power for more general use, and to give people a chance to move from poor land to better land by irrigating thousands of acres that need only water to provide an opportunity to make a good living. I saw bare and burned hillsides where only a few years ago great forests were growing. They are now being planted to young trees, not only to stop erosion, but to provide a lumber supply for the future. I saw CCC boys and WPA workers building check dams and small ponds and terraces to raise the water table and make it possible for farms and villages to remain in safety where they now are. I saw the harnessing of the turbulent Missouri, a muddy stream with the topsoil of many states. And I saw barges on new channels carrying produce and freight athwart the nation. Let me give you two simple illustrations of why government projects of this type have a national importance for the whole country and not merely a local importance. In the Boise Valley in Idaho, I saw a district which had been recently irrigated to enormous fertility, so that a family can now make a pretty good living from 40 acres of its land. Many of the families who are making good in that valley today moved there from 1,000 miles away. They came from the dust strip that runs through the middle of the nation, all the way from the Canadian border to Texas, a strip which includes large portions of 10 states. That valley in western Idaho, therefore, assumes at once a national importance as a second chance for willing farmers.
And year by year, we propose to add more valleys, to take care of thousands of other families who need the same kind of a second chance in new green pastures. The other illustration was at the Grand Coulee Dam in the state of Washington. The engineer in charge told me that almost half of the whole cost of that dam to date had been spent for materials that were manufactured east of the Mississippi River, giving employment and wages to thousands of industrial workers in the eastern third of the nation, 2,000 miles away. All of this work needs, of course, a more business-like system of planning, a greater foresight than we use today. And that is why I recommended to the last session of the Congress the creation of 7 planning regions in which local people will originate and coordinate recommendations as to the kind of this work to be done in their particular region. The Congress, of course, will determine the projects to be selected within the budget limits. To carry out any 20th century program, we must give to the executive branch of the government 20th century machinery to work with. I recognize that democratic processes are necessarily, and I think rightly, slower than dictatorial processes. But I refuse to believe that democratic processes need be dangerously slow. For many years, we have all known that the executive and administrative departments of the government in Washington are a higgledy-piggledy patchwork of duplicate responsibilities and overlapping powers. The reorganization of this vast government machinery, which I proposed to the Congress last winter, does not conflict with the principle of the democratic process, as some people say. It only makes that process work more efficiently. On my recent trip, many people have talked to me about the millions of men and women and children who still work at insufficient wages and over long hours. American industry has searched the outside world to find new markets, but it can create on its very doorstep the biggest and most permanent market it has ever seen. It needs the reduction of trade barriers to improve its foreign markets, but it should not overlook the chance to reduce the domestic trade barrier right here, right away, without waiting for any treaty. A few more dollars a week in wages, a better distribution of jobs with a shorter working day, will almost overnight make millions of our lowest paid workers actual buyers of billions of dollars of industrial and farm products. That increased volume of sales ought to lessen other cost of production so much that even a considerable increase in labor costs can be absorbed without imposing higher prices on the consumer. I am a firm believer in fully adequate pay for all labor. But right now, I am most greatly concerned in increasing the pay of the lowest paid labor, those who are our most numerous consuming group, but who today do not make enough to maintain a decent standard of living or to buy the food and the clothes and the other articles necessary to keep our factories and farms fully running. I think that far-sighted businessmen already understand and agree with this policy. They agree also that no one section of the country can permanently benefit itself or the rest of the country by maintaining standards of wages and hours that are far inferior to other sections of the country. Most businessmen, big and little, know that their government neither wants to put them out of business nor to prevent them from earning a decent profit. In spite of the alarms of a few who seek to regain control over American life, most businessmen, big and little, know that their government is trying to make property more secure than ever before by giving every family a real chance to have a property stake in the nation. Whatever danger there may be to the property and profits of the many, if there be any danger, comes not from government's attitude towards business, but from restraints now imposed upon business by private monopolies and financial oligarchies. The average businessman knows that a high cost of living is a great deterrent to business, and that business prosperity depends much upon a low price policy which encourages the widest possible consumption. As one of the country's leading economists recently said, the continuance of business recovery in the United States depends far more on business policies, business pricing policies, than it does on anything that may be done or not done in Washington. Our competitive system is, of course, not altogether competitive. Anybody who buys any large quantity of manufactured goods knows this, whether it be the government or an individual buyer. We have antitrust laws, to be sure, but they have not been adequate to check the growth of many monopolies. Whether or not they might have been originally adequate, interpretation by the courts and the difficulties and delays of legal procedure have now definitely limited their effectiveness. We are already studying how to strengthen our antitrust laws in order to end monopoly, not to hurt, but to free the legitimate business of the nation. I have touched briefly on these important subjects, which taken together make a program for the immediate future. And I know you will realize that to attain it, legislation is necessary. As we plan today for the creation of ever higher standards of living for the people of the United States, we are aware that our plans may be most seriously affected by events in the world outside our borders. By a series of trade agreements, we have been attempting to recreate the trade of the world, that trade of the world that plays so important a part in our domestic prosperity. But we know that if the world outside our borders falls into the chaos of war, world trade will be completely disrupted. Nor can we view with indifference the destruction of civilized values throughout the world. We seek peace, not only for our generation, but also for the generation of our children. We seek for them, our children, the continuance of world civilization, in order that their American civilization may continue to be invigorated, helped by the achievements of civilized men and women in all the rest of the world. I want our great democracy to be wise enough to realize that aloofness from war is not promoted by unawareness of war. In a world of mutual suspicions, peace must be affirmatively reached for. It cannot just be wished for, and it cannot just be waited for. We have now made known our willingness to attend a conference of the parties to the Nine-Power Treaty of 1922, the Treaty of Washington, of which we are one of the original signatories. The purpose of this conference will be to seek by agreement a solution of the present situation in China. In efforts to find that solution, it is our purpose to cooperate with the other signatories to this treaty, including China and Japan. Such cooperation would be an example of one of the possible paths to follow in our search for means toward peace throughout the whole world. The development of civilization and of human welfare is based on the acceptance by individuals of certain fundamental decencies in their relation with each other. And equally, the development of peace in the world is dependent similarly on the acceptance by nations of certain fundamental decencies in their relation with each other. Ultimately, I hope each nation will accept the fact that violations of these rules of conduct are an injury to the well-being of all nations. Meanwhile, remember that from 1913 to 1921, I personally was fairly close to world events. And in that period, while I learned much of what to do, I also learned much of what not to do. The common sense, the intelligence of the people of America agree with my statement that America hates war. America hopes for peace. Therefore, America actively engages in the search for peace.
That was President Roosevelt's ninth fireside chat from Tuesday, October 12, 1937, entitled On New Legislation to Be Recommended to Congress. FDR was an American lawyer and politician who served as the 32nd President of the United States from 1933 until his death in 1945. A member of the Democratic Party, he won a record 4 presidential elections and became a central figure in world events during the first half of the 20th century. Roosevelt directed the federal government during most of the Great Depression, implementing his New Deal domestic agenda in response to the worst economic crisis in U.S. history. As a dominant leader of his party, he built the New Deal coalition, which defined modern liberalism in the United States throughout the middle third of the 20th century. His third and fourth terms were dominated by World War II, which ended shortly after he died in office. Next week, we'll listen to FDR's 11th fireside chat from Sunday, November 14, 1937, titled On the Unemployment Census. I'm Rachel Steele on 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back.
It's the fast food, 12 ounces. That's a lot of food, twice as much more nickels too. Pepsi Cola is the drink for you. Nickel, 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 nickel.